Highest I am on my mind, what will education look like in the fall? Most American children have not stepped into a classroom since mid-March, when concerns over the coronavirus shuttered schools across the country. Now, with COVID rates rising throughout the U.S., school districts are scrambling to plan how to reopen, some as early as next month. But big questions remain about how to balance the risk of the virus with the impact on school children and their parents of keeping schools closed. Dana Goldstein is an education reporter for the New York Times. I spoke with her Monday morning. Dana, around the country, parents and educators are trying to figure out what in the world education is going to face in the fall. In yesterday's Washington Post, there was an editorial saying that something like 94% of schools around the country don't yet have a plan. What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just so many uncertainties for each local school district. The first is what the viral situation will be in their areas come August or September when they're set to reopen. A place that has virus transmission relatively under control at that time is facing a very different landscape for reopening schools than a place like some of the Sunbelt states that we're seeing right now in early July that are seeing sort of very fast rising rates of transmission of the virus. So I think in some ways it's just a bit difficult to make such a big consequential decision right now in early July. The second thing that's happening is a lack of clarity on how much money the districts have to enact the plans. There are now several sets of guidelines from federal authorities, state authorities, and also from groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics with suggestions on how to safely reopen school buildings. But whether you choose one of the more cautious sets of guidelines or one of the more liberal ones that prioritizes children being in the classroom physically, there are significant costs to outfitting a school, sort of retrofitting it to be safe in this context. And, you know, there are some estimates that schools across the country need to combine something like $100, $150 billion to be able to do this. It's everything from increasing the number of school buses so kids are not crowded onto those buses to installing hand sanitizer dispensers at child height throughout the building, protective equipment for teachers and other staff. The list of costs truly goes on and on. And districts have been telling me that they just don't know where the money's coming from right now. We're also in a big economic downturn, and the local tax revenues are really not there for this. So absent really, the federal government is the one that has the ability to provide this infusion. The House has put forward a plan, and now it's really up to the Senate to say whether they will fund this.
So from K through 12, I mean, there are so many different worries and crises to face, as you say, and there's no clarity on money. But give us a sense if at this point there are some plans across the country to somehow at least begin.
Yeah, so my colleagues and I at the Times have reported on those plans that do exist and are beginning to emerge. So for example, Fairfax, Virginia has said that they're setting a goal of 2 days of in-person school per week for families that choose that option, and others would have the option of 4 days of remote instruction that would be sort of independent, more independent from home, maybe an improved version, hopefully, of what parents and children have been experiencing this past semester, which in most places fell far short of what was needed to continue students learning in a meaningful way, unfortunately. But districts are planning to use the summer months to improve their capacity to deliver real learning remotely. So if they're able to do that, that would be good. Seattle has said, you know, between 1 and 2 days per week, depending on the age of the child, with a priority for younger children to have more time in the physical classroom because it's harder for them to remote learn. They need more adult supervision to be able to do so. So that's something that we're seeing many districts consider, whether, you know, the older teenagers can spend more time at home and maybe the younger children can spend more time in school. There's two other benefits to that. Younger children appear less likely both to catch and transmit the virus than adolescents do. And secondly, their parents are needed in the economy to go out and work. I'm a parent that's affected by this. So I know how hard the past months have been. And, you know, another X factor with all of this is whether parents feel comfortable sending their children back to school, and also whether teachers are willing to go back to work. So there's a lot to sort of balance here. Some people are very excited to go back and are willing to sort of take on some level of risk. Nobody wants to be at high risk in a school building, but some families and some teachers are ready to balance the kind of fear of the virus against the need to continue socializing, educating, et cetera. Others are in a much more careful, cautious place. Maybe they live with somebody who has a health problem, or they themselves are older or have their own health problem to deal with. So these are all competing issues that need to be balanced.
And what an incredible choice to have to make. As you say, the economy does need to get going again and needs workers, and yet the safety and health and well-being of children lies in a balance. I mean, here you've got Connecticut, New Jersey, the governors announcing that they would allow students to return to school, but leaving details up to each district. Gosh, that's got to be so confusing for parents and children alike.
Yeah, and honestly, if your governor has come out and said something, you need to wait and see what your local superintendent says to understand what will happen in your community, because it is really a local decision. Governors are laying out some frameworks here that are going to be helpful to superintendents and school boards and mayors. But it is that latter group of local officials that actually are making these decisions, have the power to make these decisions. And that is something that we're still kind of waiting to see how so many places react, because they've received conflicting advice. I mean, if you go with what the CDC recommends, desks for kids need to be 6 feet apart. The reality of that means half or a third of the class sizes that we're used to in American public schools. Well, that's basically a catastrophic change. I mean, in order to reduce class sizes by that much, you're going to need to send, you know, more than half of the kids to be at home on any given day, any given hour. However, you know, if you go by the rules of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the pediatricians, their guidelines, it's 3 feet. Then you start to have more wiggle room. It starts to become more flexible. So think about the pressure on a local superintendent. I speak to these people, but the conversations are honestly sometimes quite emotional and difficult, because this person wakes up every morning this summer and they basically have a few weeks from here to make these decisions, knowing that they could be life or death decisions for kids, for teachers. And nobody expects the COVID transmission in schools to be zero if we reopen schools. But that becomes a very difficult equation. What is an acceptable level of risk?
Well, and here you've got Mayor de Blasio of New York suggesting last Friday that all of the cities, more than 1 million students, are unlikely to return full time during this pandemic. What does that mean for the education of those children? How far back are they going to fall? How far behind?
So my reporting suggests that the average American student is looking at least 7 months of falling backwards academically. And for students who may have other disadvantages, like, for example, coming from low-income families, it could be as much as a year that is lost. Now, that only accounts for the losses we've already experienced from the previous school year. So this continuing situation has the potential to change people's life courses. Unfortunately, we do know from other sort of disasters that interrupted education, like Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, that the high school dropout rate went up a lot. And these are events that kind of combine personal trauma. So the personal trauma of losing your home with the educational disruption of your school being shut down. And from what we know of COVID and the pandemic, it's a similar set of issues in that it has been incredibly difficult and challenging for almost everyone, and particularly for those who face other disadvantages. And then it's also on top of that, the compounding factor of less contact with your teacher. And many districts were simply not prepared to deliver teaching in this format of online instruction. So I would say that if schools are not going to be physically available 5 days a week, the only way to mitigate the loss of learning and the social emotional loss would be to get much better at providing a few different things over the computer, basically. And those are teaching, kind of live interactive contact with educators, but also therapy of various types, counseling. So these are the challenges that districts face.
I mean, there's so much involved in bringing kids back into the classroom, and at the same time, so much is lost by not bringing them back into the classroom. What a tough balance.
It's a terrible set of choices to be confronted with. And, you know, I engage on social media and a lot of conversations with teachers and others about this. And I think what is really unfortunate is that if the virus was under control, we wouldn't face such a horrible set of choices. But the failure to get the virus itself under control is what is largely responsible for us facing this terrible set of choices.
What about children with special needs, and how are they going to be helped and cared for, perhaps by the schools or perhaps by the parents?
Yeah, I think the situation for special education students, those with disabilities, is among the sadder stories out of this. So many students with special needs really rely on schools for so many different types of services. You know, I have a friend whose child was receiving a lot of care from public sources, like just on physical stuff, like his walk and his, you know, physical needs. And those have not been available to him during the pandemic. You know, autistic children may receive social cues, counseling that really rely on being face-to-face. And there may really be a lot lost in doing it over the screen. So parents of those kids are highly concerned. Now, some districts are looking into prioritizing those children for physical back to school. So that's another thing that's going to happen, is there may be some sort of triage that goes on here. So you send a survey out to parents and you find out what number of them want their kid back in the classroom. But maybe, and this could be true, in many places, more parents want to go back than they can afford to bring back. So then it may be, okay, we're going to bring back students with special needs. We may bring back some students on free and reduced price lunch because they may not have as much access to high quality internet at home, for example. So let's bring them into the building for physical learning. And then maybe a lot of kids that would also benefit from being there are not going to be there because they're not as high needs as those other groups. So this type of triaging of education is not something we're obviously used to in this country.
And what about parents? Parents who are trying to juggle their work at home, if they are fortunate enough to be able to work at home, their schedules are gone. I mean, they're trying to do their parenting work, their work at home, but the pressure on those parents has to be so enormously acute.
Yes, it's very hard. You know, many who are lucky, who are, say, dual career professional couples are doing something that's very stressful, which is sort of splitting working and childcare with a partner. Many who are less lucky have a much worse situation. Some people have been forced to reduce their work hours in order to oversee just basic childcare for their kids, or to supervise online learning, or they have just made the difficult choice that they're not going to be able to supervise online learning. And so they may be dropping their child off, say with an elderly relative who's not familiar with using these different tools like Google Classroom or Zoom. You know, some grandparents may excel at using those tools if they're providing childcare. Some may not be able to or may not be proficient in English, so it's hard for them to communicate with the teacher. And, you know, maybe mom is out working at a hospital as a nurse or something like that. So parents face an incredibly hard set of choices. And I think right now we're starting to hear more parents speaking up about it. Our reporting has shown since about April, it's been well known that there's this group of children who are lost to the school system. So when the pandemic shut down schools in March and schools started to transition online, in many big cities, it was something like half of kids were not regularly showing up or maybe not even showing up at all for these video meetups with their classmates and teachers. And the teachers would make great efforts in some cases to find these families, calling mom, grandma, you know, maybe even sending stuff in the regular paper mail and just hoping for anything, email, text message. And some families just sort of fell off the communication track with the schools and the kids were not participating. So those sorts of stories are why I think so many leaders in the education field are pretty desperate to get back to physical school. I mean, there's just a sense that the level of need out there in the country is very, very high for this.
There have been some articles written suggesting that it's really been hard on working moms, that they are the ones being crushed by this burden.
We do see a gender inequity in how this is playing out. I mean, I'll tell you, when I get on the phone to interview a parent about how this is all going, it's always the mother, either because the mom is the only parent or because within a couple, it has fallen on the mom to be the point person to manage remote learning. And that is the reality of how this is playing out. There have been, you know, reports of women quitting their jobs or even shutting down their own successful businesses in order to handle this. There's no doubt this is going to be something that has a long-term impact on women's ability to earn and to provide for themselves and their families and to further their own goals as well.
I wonder whether early on in the virus and in the pandemic, employers seemed more understanding at first, perhaps not themselves prepared for the long-term eventuality. And now facing that need, they're laying off people who cannot do the work they need them to do.
Yeah, this is the big fear of so many experts who look at women's employment, that employers in March and April were sort of carried along by a wave of good feeling and a sense of the historic nature of this crisis, and realized that parents were going to need flexibility. But as the economic realities continue to accrue, the economy is suffering in many industries. And as employers realize how long-term we might be in a disrupted society here, that it may be till we get a vaccine, and we don't know if that's later this calendar year or a year from now or when,
right,
that the flexibility may dry up. And again, this is going to be probably hitting women very disproportionately compared to men.
More of my conversation with Dana Goldstein when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Dana Goldstein of the New York Times. Dana, let's talk about remote learning and just how successful or not it has proven to be thus far.
So it has not proven to be very successful so far. And I think we need to give some credit to school districts for exactly how unprecedented this crisis was. As recently as late February, early March, people did not think in this country that we were going to go into, you know, mass social distancing with the entire nation's schools shut down. I mean, I wrote my first piece about the potential for the pandemic to shut down schools on February 27th. At that time, it seemed like a remote possibility. Also, at that time, the federal government was not recommending the use of masks. And I remember writing that into my piece. It's crazy to think back on what life was like right before all this. So when I started calling schools in early March to say, have you thought about the possibility of shutting down and providing mass remote learning? I will be frank, they did not even want to speak about that possibility. They were that just flustered by the idea that within a few weeks' time, they would be asked to do this.
So they were totally unprepared as it began.
Yes. I mean, in late February, early March, a few CDC officials came out and did press conferences where they suggested that this might be coming. This idea of remote learning or hybrid learning with a combination of online and in-person. And so I started to call districts and say, do you have a plan for this? And the answer was, it was essentially no. We've never really thought about doing something like that on a large scale. Maybe we have a pilot program or one school that is enthusiastic about online learning, but the system was unprepared. So in the first few weeks of the shutdown in late March, early April, it was really all about getting computers and internet connections to those kids that didn't already have those at home. And then also the meals program. You know, many American children rely on school for breakfast and lunch. And the superintendents and the school officials were rightly focused on getting those systems up and running in a socially distanced, safe way so that people could come pick up meals or the meals could be delivered to children's homes. So for many places, it really wasn't until mid-April or even later that they really started getting teachers and kids connected online. And even then, they still continued to face issues with their low-income populations not having the devices and the connections that they need. I mean, if school gives you a Chromebook, but your internet connection is not great and you can't afford to upgrade it, that's not helpful. Or if a local philanthropy has helped provide you with an internet connection, but the school issued laptop is broken down for you that day, then that's also not super helpful. You do need both things to be working. And, you know, for some parents or guardians that don't necessarily use a computer a lot in their own work, which is a lot of people, you know, they weren't necessarily super well equipped to get their kids making the most of this. And it wasn't because they weren't trying. I mean, the federal government did some great surveys of households, and it turned out across lines of class and race, parents were spending all about the same amount of time trying to manage their kids' learning, which is 13 hours per week, which is quite an enormous amount of time to do something. But it didn't work out that well. I think another aspect of this was that teachers were not necessarily required to interact live on video with their students. They were not necessarily required to have contact with each individual child. Now, why was that? Teachers are also parents. Teachers are also facing all of the same pressures, many of them, that the rest of us are. And there was a sense of wanting to provide flexibility to the workforce, and also unions were demanding this. I think as we go into potentially what could be a long-term situation of remote learning, for many students, there will need to be some sort of reassessment of whether we need to be asking more of the education system, and whether it is in fact reasonable to demand that teachers and students be in direct live contact with one another. And what may need to happen is that the teachers who are best and most skilled at that type of work are directed in that direction for this period, and others do other types of tasks that need to get done. You know, for those districts that are providing a choice between in-person and remote, you have to also make sure that the right people are doing sort of each one.
Exactly.
But you also don't want to force people to go back to the physical building if they're not in good enough health to take on the risk. So it's a very complicated workforce challenge.
You know, it goes back to the question of the community at large and whether that community will take responsibility for slowing the pandemic. If that community spread slowed, that might allow those kids back in the classroom. But in so many communities, that doesn't seem to be happening.
That's right. I mean, it's hard to see for many parents who are struggling. It's hard to see that bars and restaurants are reopened and schools are potentially going to fall by the wayside. I mean, many commentators have pointed out we've bailed out the airline industry and schools are still waiting for the money they need to be able to continue operations in this climate. So unfortunately, to tell you something about our priorities as a nation.
There's been so much focus on the elderly population and the risk. But that now seems to be slowing and focusing more on younger people. Now it would seem we really have to begin to focus on the youngest people if we want this democracy of ours to continue and the education of these young people on which the democracy depends.
Yeah, the long-term impact of losing potentially a whole second school year here is potentially catastrophic. And I think we're seeing, you know, as we see that the case count unfortunately goes up, but the death count is lower. You know, one of the pieces of good news may be that high-risk populations like older adults are staying home more and are maybe more able to do that. This population of younger children are a population that fortunately are rather unlikely to become ill or seriously ill from COVID, but the impact of the pandemic on them is quite severe, the social and emotional and educational impact. So again, it is all about not reducing risk to zero for children and educators, which is impossible, unfortunately, in the situation we're in, but mitigating risk to a point that's tolerable, perhaps, for the system to continue its work.
Dana, what about other countries? What have they managed to do as far as educating the youngsters?
So school is back in session across wide swaths of Europe and Asia. And the initial evidence is that schools in those countries do not seem to be playing a very big role in spreading COVID within communities. Now, there have been some clustered outbreaks that are associated with schools in places like Israel and France. In South Korea, they initially reopened schools and then shut them back down for a time before reopening. I think what's important to say about the South Korean example, which gets mentioned a lot, is that when they shut down schools after that initial reopening, it was not because the schools were spreading the virus. It's because there was a surge in cases that was tied to workplaces like warehouses where adults congregate. And they wanted to be extremely cautious, so they chose to shut down the schools. So when you see, for example, that students or teachers get COVID, you want to have contact tracing in place. So you know the answer to the question, does the teacher have COVID because they caught it here at the school? Or does the teacher have COVID because the transmission rate is high out there in the community? That is sadly a piece that we are lacking in many parts of the United States right now. Right now, there's unfortunately about 900 teachers and students who are associated with childcare centers in Texas who have gotten COVID. But without sophisticated contact tracing, you do not know what role the centers themselves played in this situation when you have tens of thousands of people at these centers. But though they also go food shopping and they also see their own families and their own homes, those are also places you can catch the coronavirus. So in addition to figuring out what we're doing with schools, it's just intimately tied in with the bigger problem that we have, which is that some places in the country, like New York City, where I am, have made some great strides with establishing European-like contact tracing and testing systems. But in other places in the country, this work is nascent or just not happening. And that is going to play a very big part in preventing schools from potentially doing what they need to do here.
Looking at various parts of the country with the number of cases we're seeing now, especially in southern states, how likely do you think it's going to be that school reopenings are going to have to be scrapped altogether?
Well, I hesitate to make a prediction, but I do think the plans will need to be revisited potentially within a week of each district's reopening date. Now, for those who live in the northern part of the country, you may not realize that a typical school start date in the south could be August 9th, August 10th. So this is coming a lot faster at us than we think it is. What is one of the ironies here is that some of the states that seem to be moving most aggressively toward reopening schools are the same exact places where the virus is now surging. So in a Tennessee, a Texas, a Florida, I do expect to see some last minute, potentially shocking decisions coming down from districts that have maybe sent a positive message to parents that we do expect to be back to business somewhat as usual. There may be places who have announced that need to rethink that if the transmission rate in late July, early August is what it looks like right now in early July. Superintendents who may have felt really enthusiastic a few weeks ago about reopening schools may get cold feet, rightfully so, if they're looking at these numbers in their communities and really seeing a lot of sickness and potentially death around them.
How much of all this do you think is going to play out in the political campaigns this fall?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, I have not seen this question of whether our kids need a lot more education at this time ascend to the presidential race, to be frank. I haven't seen Vice President Biden really speak intensely about it. President Trump has made a few sort of hand-waving gestures toward the importance of reopening school. We'll have to wait and see if it becomes a bigger issue. It's not an issue that's obviously partisan in any way. I think that the challenges that, say, rural districts face in predominantly conservative parts of the country are in some ways not different than the ones that a low-income urban neighborhood are facing. I mean, the problems of lack of access to internet, of, you know, economically strapped parents who are having trouble overseeing remote learning. These are common shared problems across lines of geography, different types of communities, lines of race, that potentially could bring the political system together for bipartisan cooperation. I mean, it just feels though that whenever we talk about the potential for cooperation in this country, unfortunately, we rarely see that take place. I mean, the initial federal stimulus money that came down, some of that did filter to schools, about 1% of it, but that was not adequate. And, you know, what superintendents keep telling me is that what we received in 2009, 2010 far exceeded this stimulus. So the stimulus from the recession, the Great Recession, far exceeded what they're receiving here. But for them, this is a bigger, worse crisis because of the need to change fundamental operating and logistical procedures.
Dana, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
I think your questions were great, Diane. I think you're right. This is a question of our country's future and what sort of future we'd like to see. I think there's ways to make remote learning better, and there's also ways to mitigate risk inside physical buildings. And the hardest thing about this summer, the summer of 2020, from an education perspective, is that both of those paths need to be walked down simultaneously. The path of safe physical reopening and the path of very rapid improvement in our ability to teach children online.
Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Dana Goldstein. She's a national correspondent for The New York Times, writing about how education policies impact families, students, and teachers across the country. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during this very difficult time. Do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all, and do stay safe. Wear that mask. I'm Diane Rehm.